Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our final offering this semester in the Dean's Lecture and Concert Series here at St. John's College in Santa Fe. I'm Walter Sterling, the Dean of the college here, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all. We have been thrilled to have folks from our whole community, students, faculty, and staff, and friends, and alumni from both campuses able to join in these events in this format. And that's been one of the pleasures and consolations of this challenging journey that we've been on. So welcome. Next week for our campus community members, I'll alert you to the fact that we have our end of the semester collegium with music and performances from our community. And that will be recorded and then shared on Friday. And I hope many of you will participate and join us in that event, which will then be shared on our YouTube page, as will this lecture and others from this semester. So find your way back there to see what else we've had on offer this fall. And looking ahead to the spring, our first Friday lecture will be January 18th. The end of that week. I think Monday is the 18th. That's the first day of our semester, and so I believe it will be the 22nd, if my math is right there. So tune in again then. It is my pleasure to welcome this afternoon Professor Diana Schaub. She is the Professor of Political Science at Loyola University, Maryland, Visiting Professor of Political Theory in the Government Department at Harvard University, and a visiting scholar at the American Enterprise Institute. She was the Garwood Teaching Fellow at Princeton University in 2011-12, and she's the author of a book on Montesquieu, along with many scholarly articles in the fields of political philosophy and American political thought. She is a co-editor with Amy and Leon Cass, other dear friends of St. John's College, of the volume, What So Proudly We Hail, The American Soul in Story, Speech, and Song. Professor Schaub was going to be a keynote speaker at a conference that we were holding last April on democracy, liberal education, and the common good. That was canceled or postponed. We dream of reconvening that on the far side of this moment that we're in. But we're thrilled, and Professor Schaub, I just can't thank you enough both for your intention to join us for that event. We count on bringing you to our campus in time, but I'm so glad you were willing to join us today. And if I understand from you correctly, you have lectured in Annapolis before. I know you have many connections and much familiarity with St. John's College, and we're thrilled to be able to welcome you, so to speak, for the first time to the Santa Fe campus. So with that, I will hand things over to Professor Schaub, who is the title of her lecture this afternoon is Learning to Love Lincoln, Frederick Douglass's Journey from Grievance to Gratitude. Professor Schaub.
Hey, thank you, Walter. I'm delighted to be here to give a Friday lecture. I have always admired this St. John's tradition. I'm also delighted to be able to talk about my two heroes, Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. I'll be focusing on what one of them had to say about the other. Frederick Douglass, in his great oration in memory of Lincoln, delivered in 1876 upon the occasion of the dedication of the Freedmen's Monument, observed that, quote, any man can say things that are true of Abraham Lincoln, but no man can say anything that is new of Abraham Lincoln. That is still the case today. Not even by resorting to lies and untruths can one find anything new to say about Abraham Lincoln. The truths and untruths, and maybe most common, the half-truths, have all been around a long time. The task is thus not to be original in one's appreciation, but to be just. Proper appreciation of Lincoln's statesmanship, particularly during his lifetime, was rare. The contrast with George Washington is instructive. Although both experts and ordinary citizens now routinely consider Washington and Lincoln the greatest of American presidents, Washington's rank as a statesman was clear, uncontested from the first, so uncontested that his election to the presidency was unanimous, while the election of Lincoln was so contentious as to provoke civil war. In addition to the seditious opposition of the South, encountered plenty of loyal opposition in the North, not only from Democrats, but from those more radical than he, both within the Republican Party and outside it, among the various strands of abolitionists. Radicals, then and now, have been particularly stinting in their praise of Lincoln. Some today suggest that credit for emancipation belongs more to those like Frederick Douglass, who pressured Lincoln to take that decisive step. At the extreme, this position asserts that Lincoln was anti-Black, that the proclamation was basically a fraud, and that Lincoln does not deserve any credit for emancipation since he was forced into glory. Now, before signing on to that contemporary radical critique, we might want to examine what the greatest of the abolitionists himself had to say about Lincoln, from his newspaper editorials before and during the war, to his speeches and personal reminiscences after the war. The trajectory of Douglass's thinking about Lincoln is one of increasing and deepening appreciation, often revising his own earlier negative assessments. Perhaps because Douglass was self-educated, he remained a lifelong learner, capable of open-minded and rigorous reconsiderations. The way in which the exercise of his critical faculties could lead him to substantive reevaluations was evident early in his career when he dramatically changed his opinion about the status of slavery under the Constitution, repudiating the Garrisonian view of the pro-slavery character of the Constitution. Douglass embraced an anti-slavery reading of the document, thereby transforming himself from a revolutionary intent on annulling the Constitution to a reformer, still fiercely critical of American practice, but ever after a staunch defender of America's founding principles. A parallel but more subtle shift occurred as a result of Douglass's encounter with Lincoln, an encounter that taught him to appreciate the statesman, which is to say the prudent politician, as well as the John Browns of the world. Douglass learned to love Lincoln, and in his 1876 oration in memory of Lincoln, he recapitulated that intellectual and emotional journey for the benefit of all Americans. Douglass's oration was the keynote address at the unveiling of the nation's first statue in honor of Lincoln. The statue is entitled Emancipation, and it was erected in the name of the former slaves and was paid for exclusively through their donations. As befitted the ceremonial nature of the occasion, Douglass's speech expressed gratitude towards Lincoln. But more intriguingly, it reflected on the political significance of gratitude. It is a speech both of gratitude and about gratitude. Douglass says that the sentiment of gratitude, which perpetuates the memories of great public men, is one of the noblest that can stir and thrill the human heart. Further, he points out that with the dedication of the Freedmen's Monument, Black Americans now, for the first time in the history of our people, he says, join in this high worship. Douglass wants the world to notice what we, the colored people, are doing in honoring Abraham Lincoln. As he explains, first things are always interesting, and this is one of our first things. Douglass presents the Black commemoration of Lincoln as an act that honors the honorers almost as much as it honors the honoree. Now, the story of how the Freedmen's Memorial took the shape that it did, and Douglass's role in ensuring that his people's first national act came off well, is a fascinating one. Douglass was asked right after the war, right after the assassination of Lincoln in 1865, to lend his name to the Educational Monument Association. The association proposed to raise money from Blacks and whites alike to build a Black college in honor of Lincoln's memory. Douglass refused to participate in the project. And here's what he wrote in his letter to the organizers. He says, "For a monument, by itself and upon its own merits, I say good. For a college, by itself and upon its own merits, I say good. But for a college monument or for a monument college, I do not say good. The whole scheme is derogatory to the character of the colored people of the United States. It looks to me like an attempt to wash the Black man's face in the nation's tears for Abraham Lincoln. I am for washing the Black man's face. That is, educating his mind, for that is a good thing to be done. and I appreciate the nation's tears for Abraham Lincoln, but I am not so enterprising as to think of turning the nation's veneration for our martyred president into a means of advantage to the colored people and of sending around the hat to a mourning public. So Douglas doesn't want gratitude, which he calls one of the holiest sentiments of the human heart, to be contaminated with blatant self-interest. For gratitude isn't even gratitude then. In the proposed college monument, the problem of impure motives would have been even worse, since there would be not just a mixture of motives, but actually a division of motives along racial lines. Whites would be doing the creditable giving and Blacks the self-interested taking. Douglas does not want his people to enter upon citizenship in that way. Instead of an ennobling display of Black gratitude, which would elevate the givers, and moreover, elevate the givers in the minds of white observers, the college monument idea would reduce Blacks primarily to the role of recipients. Now, Douglas was not, in principle, opposed to white philanthropy on behalf of Blacks. Years earlier, he had sketched a plan for an industrial college in answer to an inquiry from Harriet Beecher Stowe about what she could do to contribute to Black advancement. However, Douglas was always sensitive to the dangers of ill-timed or overly intrusive assistance, which could have the perverse effect of sapping Black initiative, thereby impeding the long-term prospects of the race. Douglas was worried that there was always more of benevolence and pity rather than straightforward justice in white America's dealings with Blacks. His preference was for justice, sternly and blindly equal, with no special pleadings or privileges. This leads to what at first might seem a contradiction in Douglas's reaction to the Monument College project. As is well known, Douglas's vision for America is fundamentally integrationist. Nonetheless, he wants the monument to be exclusively a Black effort. However humble, he says, it should be our own act and deed. On the other hand, when it comes to the idea of a college, Douglas speaks not only against the self-serving hybrid of the Monument College, but also against the idea of any college being built for the permanent and exclusive use of Blacks. Given the discrimination of the day, Douglas admitted there was a need for temporary recourse to what he called complexional institutions. But he did not want to see the founding of any institution that accepted the permanence of segregation. As he says, the American people must stand each for all and all for each without respect to color or race. So he's in favor of a separately erected monument, but opposed to a separate college. Why a freedman's memorial, but not a freedman's college? What accounts for his different judgment on these two endeavors?
The explanation, I think, hinges on the nature of the two undertakings and their potential contribution to either lessening racial prejudice or prolonging it. A display of gratitude by Black Americans,
reflecting the special sentiments that they bear towards Lincoln, would undercut white prejudice by showing that Blacks were capable of the holiest sentiments of the human heart.
Conversely, a college explicitly and exclusively reserved to Blacks, whoever foots the bill for it, by accommodating racial prejudice, in effect bolsters it. Thus, Douglas accepts all Black institutions only with great reluctance and always with the proviso that as soon as circumstances permit, Blacks must make
their way into the majority institutions. Douglas is consistent in that he judges instances of race solidarity and group action by their effects on friendship between the races. So his guiding question is always, does the doing of this deed point us toward the overcoming of race prejudice and contribute to an ethos of common citizenship? Acts of Black self-reliance, both individual and group-based, can create the conditions for non-racial
Douglas understood that before the Black man could
be recognized as a brother, he must first be
recognized as a man. So manliness precedes fraternity. Or to give it a non-gendered formulation, independence precedes friendship. As Douglas had hoped, the Monument College plan was abandoned, and in the end, the memorial took the pure form that he had recommended, with Douglas himself delivering the keynote address. And not surprisingly, his first paragraph refers to the manly pride with which Blacks should view the occasion, while the final paragraph sets forth the Black claim to human brotherhood. More especially, Douglas informs those whites who seek to scourge Blacks beyond the range of human brotherhood that the Freedmen's Monument stands as a refutation of their blighting slander. In between the opening invocation of manliness or independence and the closing invocation of brotherhood or friendship, the speech itself demonstrates how a still very divided nation could develop a shared perspective on the achievements of Abraham Lincoln. Any analysis of the speech must take into account not only the uniqueness of the occasion, but the rhetorical dilemma posed by the larger historical moment. Remember, the speech is given in 1876. The Reconstruction period is coming to an end. The federal government is increasingly reluctant to enforce the 14th and 15th Amendments, and Douglas was very worried about the resurgent spirit of the Old South. Douglas worried that reconciliation between Northern and Southern whites would end up excluding the freedmen and thereby erasing the real meaning of the Civil War. Thus, he attempts to use the memory of Lincoln counteract that dangerous tendency, and in effect to revive the new birth of freedom. The oration has a careful structure. What I'm going to do now is just sort of take us through the speech. I'm hoping that maybe some of you are familiar with it. The oration has a very careful structure. It's composed of 8 distinct sections, and each of those sections begins with what grammarians call a vocative expression. In the first 2 sections, the vocative is friends and fellow citizens. And in the subsequent 6 sections, the vocative is simply fellow citizens. So first 2, friends and fellow citizens, the next 6, fellow citizens. Now, politicians, of course, you know, rely on direct address of this sort all the time. Often it becomes a kind of verbal tic. Think of Lyndon Johnson, you know, in his Texas accent, which I can't imitate, peppering his speeches with, you know, my fellow Americans. Douglas, though, is doing this much more deliberately. His iterations, I think, signal new phases of an argument. An argument that delineates the different but not irreconcilable claims of whites and Blacks to the memory of Lincoln. Douglas begins the oration by addressing his immediate audience, those who assembled that day in Lincoln Park, due east of the Capitol building, on the 11th anniversary of Lincoln's assassination. The audience was a large one and racially mixed. It was composed of 25,000 ordinary citizens, along with numerous representatives of official Washington. Douglas mentions the presence of members of the House of Representatives and the Senate, the presence of the Chief Justice and all the members of the Supreme Court, and President Grant himself. These attendees deserve to be called not just fellow citizens, but friends. Their very attendance gives evidence of their sympathies. Interestingly, this first section of the speech makes no mention at all of Lincoln, but instead congratulates you, a pronoun that seems to refer, at least initially, only to Douglas's fellow Blacks. Thus, he speaks of our condition as a people and the remarkable progress in that condition. The evidence of progress, which Douglas says is a credit to American civilization, provides the occasion for a shift to congratulating all. Douglas notes that the new dispensation of freedom has come both to our white fellow citizens and ourselves. The second section of the speech acknowledges especially the federal government and its friendly role in this new dispensation. The erection of the memorial received congressional approval And the pedestal for the statue was paid for by congressional appropriation. So the statue itself was paid for by the freedmen, and the pedestal paid for by Congress. And the day of the dedication had in fact been declared a federal holiday. Douglas highlights the awful sacrifice that lies behind this federal friendship. This section contains his first mention of Lincoln, and he calls him the first martyr president of the United States. Moreover, Lincoln's martyrdom is presented as the climax of the larger national sacrifice to which Douglas alludes with his reference to yonder heights of Arlington. Arlington Cemetery was visible from Lincoln Park, and 16,000 Civil War soldiers were buried there, including 1,500 Black troops. On the 11th anniversary of Lincoln's death, what Douglas wanted to remind his audience of was blood-bought freedom, our blood-bought freedom, in which we, the colored people, rejoice. While Douglas emphasizes the sentiment of appreciation that gives rise to monuments like the one being unveiled, curiously, he says nothing about the actual statue. And it is known that he was not altogether pleased with the design. And at this point, I'm going to try to share my screen with you. Okay, can you all see that? Yes, no, we hope so. Walter, are you still there? Can everybody see this?
Yes.
Good, okay. That's the statue. Okay, Douglas was not altogether pleased with the design, and people today are even less pleased with it. I'm going to stop the sharing. Maybe during the question period, we can sort of return to this statue and talk a little bit more about its meaning and aesthetics. Okay, stop share.
Diana, while I'm here, yes. I'm going to let you know, your audio is varying some. A couple of people have commented. It keeps coming through, but it sort of shifts a little bit. So I just encourage
you. I may actually just unplug the mic. Sometimes I get better results without the mic.
Let's give that a shot because that might be switching back and forth.
Okay, let's do that. Okay. All right, so the statue shows Lincoln, Emancipation Proclamation in one hand, standing over the crouching or half-rising figure of a slave. Now, dissatisfaction with the sculpture was not limited to Douglas. It was shared by others, and the official program for the festivities attempted to address these objections. It had a paragraph explaining that, quote, in the original design, the kneeling slave was represented as perfectly passive, receiving freedom from the hand of the great liberator. But the artist justly changed this to bring the presentation nearer to the historical fact by making the emancipated slave an agent in his own deliverance. He is accordingly represented as exerting his own strength with strained muscles in breaking the chain which had bound him. The brochure also mentions that there was an alternative design by the female sculptor, Harriet Hosmer. It had to be rejected as too costly. That design would have depicted Lincoln atop a central pillar flanked by smaller pillars showing, among other figures, Black Union soldiers. Douglas, I think, would certainly have preferred this design. That design would have embodied his favorite aphorism. He quoted this aphorism in speech after speech. The lines come from Lord Byron, and here's the phrase: "Hereditary bondsmen, know ye not, who would be free themselves must strike the blow." In a sense, Douglas's speech corrects the submissiveness or paternalism of the statue, because Douglas's speech acknowledges both our loyal, brave, and patriotic soldiers and the vast, high, and preeminent services rendered to ourselves, to our race, to our country, and to the whole world by Abraham Lincoln. In other words, Douglas's praise of Lincoln is balanced by his recognition of Black agency, the invaluable contribution made by Black Union troops. Remember, by war's end, there were 180,000 Black troops. Having spent the opening two sections proclaiming the generous deed of the moment and commending it to the notice of men of all parties and opinions, including, he says, those who despise us, Douglass in the third section begins to speak to the larger nationwide audience, an audience of fellow citizens, not all of whom are necessarily friends. Douglass now treads very carefully. He does not want the Black embrace of Lincoln to trigger a white flight from Lincoln. And so he quite dramatically backs away from the great emancipator, insisting that, quote, Abraham Lincoln was not, in the fullest sense of the word, either our man or our model. In his interests, in his associations, in his habits of thought, and in his prejudices, he was a white man. He was preeminently the white man's president, entirely devoted to the welfare of white men. He was ready and willing at any time during the last years of his administration to deny, postpone, and sacrifice the rights of humanity and the colored people to promote the welfare of the white people of his country. The race to which we belong were not the special objects of his consideration. Knowing this, I concede to you, my white fellow citizens, a preeminence in this worship at once full and supreme. You are the children of Abraham Lincoln. Douglass devotes the whole of Section 3 to reassuring nervous whites, whites who are patriotic, but probably prejudiced. Basically, he tells them, look, don't worry. Lincoln always loved you best. Take it from me, a Negro. Lincoln was not a Negro lover. It's a rather startling rhetorical gambit, but it allowed Douglass to exhort white Americans to heap high their hosannas of Lincoln. He tells them, to you, it especially belongs to sound his praises, to preserve and perpetuate his memory, to multiply his statues, to hang his pictures on your walls, and commend his example, for to you, he was a great and glorious friend and benefactor. By the close of this section of the speech, which we might dub the white supremacist section, one might wonder why Blacks are bothering to honor Lincoln at all. Douglass's answer is that while whites are Lincoln's children, Blacks are his stepchildren, children by adoption, children by force of circumstances and necessity. Moreover, what Lincoln did for his stepchildren, whether it was part of his original intention or not, was deliver them from bondage. Accordingly, Douglass entreats whites to despise not the humble offering of former slaves. The separate claims of whites and Blacks upon the memory of Lincoln can coexist. Whites can honor Lincoln for saving the Union. Blacks can honor him for emancipation. Shared homage, if it is ever to develop, must begin with toleration for racially specific homage. Frederick Douglass had a gift for metaphor, and this image of Blacks as Lincoln's stepchildren is one of his finest, I think. It accords nicely with Lincoln's own account of the relationship between the cause of union and the cause of emancipation, as expressed in his famous letter to Horace Greeley. Here's what Lincoln says about his own duty as president in the letter to Greeley. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing all the slaves, I would do it. And if I could save it by freeing some and leaving others alone, I would also do that. Douglass reminds his listeners that Lincoln was a Unionist first and foremost, and that he became the great emancipator only by force of circumstances and necessity. Whites ought to revere Lincoln as the savior of the nation. And indeed, the inscription on the National Lincoln Memorial, built half a century after the Freedmen's Memorial, reads, in this temple, as in the hearts of the people for whom he saved the Union, the memory of Abraham Lincoln is enshrined forever. Of course, the Union to which Lincoln was devoted had at its foundation the principle of human equality. The Union was itself a moral project. Because the bond of genuine union is a teaching about natural rights, American patriotism ought to produce citizens who are, as Douglass says, friendly to the freedom of all men. And in the fourth and central section of the speech, Douglass presents at greater length the stepchildren's view of Lincoln, the essential feature of which was faith in Lincoln's living and earnest sympathy with their faith. Again, Douglass doesn't paper over the disagreements and the disappointments that blacks experienced during the war years. He admits, at times stunned, grieved, and greatly bewildered. Douglass provides a litany of reasons why blacks might have doubted Lincoln's goodwill. Lincoln supported colonization schemes. He refused initially to enlist black troops. After finally allowing black recruitment, he refused to retaliate when the Confederates violated the rules of warfare by massacring black prisoners. And Lincoln revoked early emancipation decrees by Union generals in the field. Nonetheless, Douglass asserts that, quote, we were able to take a comprehensive view of Abraham Lincoln, a view that took the measure of the man. And after factoring in the logic of events, and even, Douglass says, that divinity that shapes our ends, we came to the conclusion that the hour and the man of our redemption had met in the person of Abraham Lincoln. Douglass then gives a counter-litany of the liberationist and racially transformative policies that transpired under Lincoln's rule. He lists 9 achievements, culminating in the Emancipation Proclamation. And each time, with each achievement, he repeats a version of the phrase, under his rule we saw. Under his rule we saw. The phrase is crucial for both whites and blacks. Blacks who longed for liberty, but who might understandably be suspicious of rule and law, having suffered under generations of misrule, are reminded that their liberty came to them through law and through wise and beneficent rule. Conversely, whites are reminded that the actions of Lincoln, which struck not only at slavery, but also at prejudice and proscription, those were the actions of a dedicated constitutionalist. The closing paragraph of section 4 celebrates emancipation and moreover shows that the celebration can be shared by all. Douglass asks, can any colored man or any white man friendly to the freedom of all men ever forget the night which followed the first day of January 1863? The date of the final issuance of the Emancipation Proclamation. Whites can appreciate black liberation and blacks can appreciate white statesmanship. Statesmanship, a word that Douglass now uses for the first, but not the last time in the address. On this new biracial basis of union and liberty, Douglass goes on to a reconsideration of Lincoln in sections 5, 6, and 7. He argues that Lincoln's great and good character was transparent to all those who saw him and heard him. Indeed, direct contact wasn't even necessary. In a passage with tremendous import for us today, Douglass says, the image of the man went out with his words, and those who read him knew him. We are indebted to biographers and historians who have scoured and scavenged through all the bits and pieces of eyewitness testimony and hearsay evidence and who have laboriously contextualized and hypothesized and speculated to such a degree that, with the exception of Jesus, there is now no one who ever walked the earth more written about than Abraham Lincoln. Nonetheless, it's reassuring to know that Lincoln's words alone are enough. In light of this fundamentalist insight, Douglass now revises his earlier white supremacist account of Lincoln. he reconsiders Lincoln's deference to popular prejudice in the appropriate context, the context of democratic statesmanship. And here's what he says at the close of section five. This is another fairly long passage, which I'm just going to read out. I have said that President Lincoln was a white man and shared the prejudices common to his countrymen towards the colored race. Looking back to his times and to the condition of the country, this unfriendly feeling on his part may safely be set down as one element of his wonderful success in organizing the loyal American people for the tremendous conflict before them and bringing them safely through that conflict. His great mission was to accomplish two things. First, to save his country from dismemberment and ruin, and second, to free his country from the great crime of slavery. To do one or the other, or both, he must have the earnest sympathy and the powerful cooperation of his loyal fellow countrymen. Without this primary and essential condition to success, his efforts must have been vain and utterly fruitless. Had he put the abolition of slavery before the salvation of the Union, he would have inevitably driven from him a powerful class of the American people and rendered resistance to rebellion impossible. Viewed from the genuine abolition ground, Mr. Lincoln seemed tardy, cold, dull, and indifferent. But measuring him by the sentiment of his country, a sentiment he was bound as a statesman to consult, he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined. Frederick Douglass himself always occupied the genuine abolition ground, and his speeches and writings from the early years of the war especially often manifested great frustration with Lincoln's caution. In retrospect, however, Douglass generously acknowledges the partiality of his own abolitionist stance, and he credits Lincoln as the comprehensive statesman. I think it is important to note that the final paragraph of this section carefully distinguishes Lincoln's views on race from his views on slavery. Douglass repeats for the third time that Lincoln was prejudiced, or more precisely, that he shared the prejudices of his white fellow countrymen against the Negro. According to Douglass, racial prejudice is a social construct. There's nothing innate or inevitable about it. It seems, though, that Douglass does not regard Lincoln as particularly progressive on the question of race. He was a follower or a sharer in the dominant opinion of the day. However, in this very same section, in which Douglass refers to Lincoln's prejudices, he explicitly says that, quote, the humblest could approach him and feel at home in his presence. This statement echoes what Douglass said elsewhere about the experience of being in Lincoln's personal presence. When he wrote about his second meeting with Lincoln, Douglass in his autobiography says, Mr. Lincoln was not only a great president, but a great man, too great to be small in anything. In his company, I was never in any way reminded of my humble origin or of my unpopular color. We might wonder whether the presentation of Lincoln's racial prejudice is compatible with the presentation of his capacious and welcoming humanity. Of course, it might be possible for someone to regard a particular class of people as inferior in certain respects, while still treating individual members of that class with consideration. In other words, Lincoln could have been both prejudiced and polite. If so, though, it would still be necessary to explain why Douglass in the oration chooses to draw attention to one quality more than the other. Perhaps he wishes to indicate to both blacks and whites that racial prejudice is not an insuperable obstacle to black advancement or bettered race relations. Alternatively, I believe it's possible to interpret Douglass's remarks in a way consistent with the view that Lincoln deferred to popular prejudice without fully subscribing to popular prejudice. The issue might be elucidated by asking, what was the nature of Lincoln's sharing in white prejudice? When he describes the relation between Lincoln and, when Douglas describes the relation between Lincoln and the sentiment of his country, Douglas credits Lincoln with being in advance of popular opinion, measured against which he was swift, zealous, radical, and determined. Douglas introduces the key verb consult, claiming that the sentiment of his country was something Lincoln was bound as a statesman to consult. To the extent that popular sentiment was unfriendly to Blacks, Lincoln's sharing in it may have been political rather than personal, deliberately affected rather than deeply held. Douglas here, I think, conveys a crucial lesson about the limits within which democratic statesmen operate. Politicians can't get too far ahead of public opinion if they hope to remain politically viable. And more than others, perhaps, Black citizens must incorporate this insight into their assessment of political figures. A comprehensive view must, Douglas says, make reasonable allowance for the circumstances and not judge on the basis of what he calls stray utterances or isolated facts. In taking the measure of Lincoln, Douglas shows how granting this latitude of maneuver is compatible with respect for the burdens of statesmanship, as well as the self-respect of citizens. I think what Douglas is trying to do really is model what it looks like to take a comprehensive view of a politician. These people are new voters, and there are two dangers they have to avoid. Douglas doesn't want Blacks to look to politics for a Moses figure, but he doesn't want them to fall into the opposite error either of cynically seeing only the flaws. He shows the possibility of appreciation without idolatry and criticism without rejection. Now, whichever way one comes down on the question of Lincoln's views on race, Douglas is emphatic that Lincoln's attitude towards slavery was above reproach. Douglas quotes from the Atonement passage of the second inaugural, in which Lincoln interpreted the Civil War as the blood price exacted by a just God for the nation's sins toward the slave. I hope everybody remembers the passage. It speaks of the war possibly continuing until all the wealth piled by the bondman's 250 years of unrequited toil shall be sunk, and until every drop of blood drawn with the lash shall be paid by another drawn with the sword. By the way, those were lines that Douglas quoted in nearly every post-war speech he gave that mentioned Lincoln. The second inaugural solemn invocation of divine reparations, Douglas says, gives all needed proof of Lincoln's feeling on the subject of slavery. Douglas now revisits an issue that he had highlighted earlier. In section 3, when he mentioned Lincoln's policy of opposition to the extension of slavery, he had stressed Lincoln's willingness to protect, defend, and perpetuate slavery in the states where it existed. This tolerance of slavery in the South was there cited as evidence of Lincoln's pro-white views. That was section 3. Now, however, in section 5, Douglas explains that Lincoln acted as he did not because he was indifferent to the fate of Black slaves, but, quote, because he thought it was so nominated in the bond. In other words, he acted out of fidelity to the Constitution as he understood it. Lincoln's pre-war willingness to leave slavery alone in the Southern states does not in any way disprove or lessen his anti-slavery convictions. Of course, Douglas himself disagreed with Lincoln about what precisely was nominated in the bond. Most notably, Douglas argued that the so-called fugitive slave clause of the Constitution did not, in fact, refer to slaves at all, but rather to indentured servants who had signed contracts and could be held accountable to those legal terms. Nonetheless, even though he is not fully in accord with Lincoln's reading of the document, Douglas moves his audience toward an appreciation of constitutional devotion. Douglas is acutely aware that racial progress in the future will depend on the fidelity of both Blacks and whites to the Constitution. The Constitution is purified and completed by the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments. Fittingly, sections 6 and 7 transcend race altogether. These are the only sections that make no reference to either whites or Blacks. Section 6 describes Lincoln's early years, his preparation through plain speaking and plain dealing for the great crisis of Civil War. Douglas emphasizes Lincoln's humble origins. He says, a son of toil himself, he was linked in brotherly sympathy with the sons of toil in every loyal part of the Republic. In this section, racial division is overcome and replaced by the class division between the patrician, James Buchanan, who Douglas says was willing to allow national dismemberment, and the plebeian, Abraham Lincoln, who had an oath in heaven to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution of the United States. So the division that we ought to dwell on, Douglas implies, is that between patriotism and treason. This theme reaches its apotheosis in Section 7, which describes the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. Despite the hell-black spirit of revenge that motivated the crime, Douglas argues that good has come from it. Dying as a martyr to union and liberty, these twin aims now conjoined and equal, Lincoln has become doubly dear to us. In his autobiography, Douglas noted that one effect of the assassination was to bring him into close accord with his white neighbors, feeling for the first time, he said, more like kin than countrymen. In the final section of the speech, section 8, just one paragraph in length, Douglas comes full circle, speaking once more to his largely Black audience. He tells them, quote,
in doing honor to the memory of our
friend and liberator, we have been doing highest honor to ourselves and those who come after us. Note that despite the reference to Lincoln's unfriendly feeling, and a feeling that an unfriendly feeling that had been ascribed to him in both in sections 3 and 5, Lincoln, by the end of the speech, has become our friend. Through his interpretation and masterful presentation of Lincoln's statesmanship, Douglas has knit together the American polity in mutual understanding and appreciation of Lincoln. Douglas, I think, has acted as a statesman himself by demonstrating how memory and memorialization, done well, might shape a better American future. In conclusion, let me just say a word about the larger lesson to be drawn from this speech. Frederick Douglass is best known as an activist and a radical. Much of his speaking and writing involved demands for justice, justice towards Blacks, justice towards women, justice towards laborers. Approached famously by a young man asking what he should do for the cause of racial justice, the elderly Douglass is said to have replied, agitate, agitate, agitate. However, this fabled agitator also devoted a goodly portion of his public speaking to commemorating the past, celebrating the founding ideals of the nation, praising those citizens and public figures who remained faithful to both the Declaration and the Constitution. In other words, he tried to foster a spirit of friendship and a unified national consciousness. Aristotle, I know in speaking to a St. John's audience, I can count on your familiarity with Aristotle. Aristotle called this homonoia, or like-mindedness. Like-mindedness, thinking the same about certain crucial matters, is the form of friendship that should characterize fellow citizens. Aristotle calls this like-mindedness the greatest of goods for the political order. It lessens civic strife among the parts or parties that are always present in any large collective. Diversity, without this foundation of like-mindedness, is a recipe for growing discord. Like-mindedness allows cooperation and trust to replace contentiousness and suspicion. Aristotle argued that lawmakers should pursue this kind of friendship more than justice, even, since civic friendship leads to justice and does so without having to involve the coercive bite of the law. In friendship, what is right and what is pleasing come naturally together. For a model of how to encourage this civic friendship, I think there are very few who equal Frederick Douglass, especially in our contemporary moment,
as protests have erupted over incidents of racial injustice, as well as over statues and memorials that are thought to symbolize or contribute to ongoing injustice.
I can't think of a better resource than Frederick Douglass. He's one of the nation's greatest fighters against injustice, and he took very seriously the topic of public commemoration. It matters intensely who we memorialize and how we understand the past.
And I just want to mention a couple of things that I think distinguish Douglass from today's protesters and progressives. Douglass was a fierce critic of our
national transgressions. He believed deeply in the American project. He called the principles of the Declaration saving principles. He called the Constitution a glorious liberty document. He is always calling upon the nation
to rise to its highest ideals, to live up to its professions.
He could be bitingly satirical, but he was never cynical. Always ready to find and praise what was good and generous and true in the American experiment. And it does seem to me
that it is that spirit of gratitude that is being lost. There's a very deep alienation expressed in much contemporary rhetoric and action.
Over the last summer, that hostility went so far as to threaten the Freedmen's Monument itself with destruction or removal. I think there are many reasons to
preserve the monument, including that it was the site of one of Douglass's most significant speeches, and that it marks what Douglass called
his people's first national act, the act by which they translated their gratitude for emancipation into an enduring work of art. This controversy
over the monument will be salutary, perhaps, if it leads us to revisit its history and, above all,
reread Douglass's speech. He can help us all towards a more thoughtful and nuanced patriotism. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Professor Schaub. So we will take just a 2-3 minute break and then come back for a question period. I do apologize, the audio continued to vary.
I've never had that problem before, so I don't know what's accounting for that.
I think I was hearing what others were hearing, and So I was able to hear it all, but there was varying quality. And so we apologize for that, but I don't think it will inhibit our ability to have a good question period. So please stick around and join us for questions and comments. And I'll explain how we'll do that for those who might be new to the format when we come back in just a couple minutes. So thank you, Diana.
Great. Okay.
Okay. Welcome back. I just put this in the chat thread, but for those who might be new to the format, there are a couple different ways you can contribute questions or comments. There's the Q&A function, which will allow you to type in a question or comment. And then you should be able to wake up a button at the bottom of your screen to raise your hand if you'd like to ask a question live voice. And we'll sort of try to keep an eye on everything. It is also possible to use the chat function to get a question to us. Looks like that might have happened already, so we might begin there. But again, I thank you, Professor Schaub, for your talk, and we will get into the discussion now. So we do have a question in the chat thread, and we'll go ahead and begin there. This is from Nestor Aranabar. Dr. Schaub, congratulations on such a great lecture. This semester learning under you, I gather you're acquainted, this semester learning under you has given me such a profound appreciation for Douglass. So this was an amazing culmination to it all. So
Nestor, that's not a question. Thank you for that. Nestor was a student in my Harvard class on African-American political thought. Do you have a question, Nestor?
And again, to all of you attending, we will wait for questions and comments.
While we're doing that, I might just put up that picture of the monument again, in case we want to have any discussion of people's reaction to it. And
I think that's a nice idea. You could just leave it up for a while.
See if I can do that here. Can you see it?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I saw a hand go up and then come down. So I'm just going to, oh, it looks like that. Let's see if it comes back up.
Well, maybe I can give my reading of this statue. Mm-hmm. Because I mentioned that, you know, Douglas wasn't that fond of the depiction, and the, you know, opposition to it has only increased since. One of the critics said that the statue is visually irredeemable. And of course, that's about the worst thing you can say about a sculpture, because sculpture is a visual medium. So to the opponents of the statue, the whole thing just looks too much like, you know, the great white Moses and blacks in this passive and receptive role. And I think also because the optics are the optics of, you know, benefaction and gratitude, and that doesn't really comport with our deepest notions of what equality and freedom mean. But I want to try to argue that there is something redemptive about the statue, if you look at it more closely. Note that it's not called freedom, it's called emancipation. So it's not meant to be a depiction of freedom. It's meant to depict the transition to freedom. It's a change of status made possible by Lincoln's executive order. So I think it captures something true about that in-between or liminal state. The freed man is not yet a free man, right? Not a free man in full. So the depiction of the slave, he's neither kneeling nor standing. He's in a half-risen posture. You know, he's poised on the brink of possibility. So I think the statue means to acknowledge that emancipation by law or under law is only the beginning of this arduous process, this journey. And significantly, the freedman is not shown looking up at Lincoln. He's nothing beseeching about it. He's not looking at Lincoln at all. He's not a supplicant. His gaze is fixed forward. No eyes on the prize. He sees the future of himself and his people. So the widened prospects come as a result of the Emancipation Proclamation, but the freedman himself is just intent on his own self-realization, his own agency. Now, most of the dissatisfaction with the statue focuses on the depiction of the freedman, but there are other elements about the statue as well. Remember, it's a statue of Lincoln. Lincoln holds the Emancipation Proclamation in one hand. His hand rests on a plinth that contains certain symbols of the nation, George Washington among them. They represent law, government, the nation's founding. Behind Lincoln, which you can't see from this angle, is a whipping post. And it's somewhat covered over with some drapery. So the artist is, I think, insisting that we remember the old way, even as we celebrate the promise of a new way. Right? Enslaved people lives under the lash, and a free people lives under law. So in moving from one order to the other, we don't forget, right, the horrors of the past or its lingering legacy. And I think the statue is honest about that. It celebrates the new birth of freedom, but it doesn't deny the nation's injustice. So you can see that also in the fact that even though the chain has been broken, the cuffs are still on the wrists of the freedmen. So the new order of the law allows for the freedman's rising, but this effort to wrench himself away from his former condition, you know, is his, and that effort has to be ongoing. So the clenched fist and the straining muscles. And then also just, you know, Lincoln itself, I mean, the statue commemorates an act of statesmanship. And rule of law is good and right, but the life of Lincoln shows that good men and wise leadership are the ultimate source of good laws. So Frederick Douglass, I think, emphasizes this point in the speech when he gives those 9 achievements of the Lincoln administration achievements that struck down prejudice and racial exclusion. So I think actually, you know, if we can actually look at the statue more and understand its symbolism, it's not visually irredeemable.
Thank you. We do have a couple of written questions here. So
okay, good.
Turn to the first one there. This is from Don Lemons. We know that Douglas had a very high regard for John Brown, even regarding him as more consistently a friend of the enslaved than Lincoln. Did Douglas's evaluation of Brown descend as his evaluation of Lincoln ascended?
Yes, that's a very good question. So I mentioned that, you know, much of Douglas's speechifying after the war were these speeches of commemoration. And that includes not only the speech about Lincoln, but a speech about John Brown. So no, I don't think so. He remains to the end a great admirer of John Brown. One might maybe expect that, yeah, as Lincoln rose, John Brown would come down a peg. I think he was in awe of Brown's dedication to the cause and the selflessness of that. As a white man, to be willing to risk everything for the cause of the slave. That's not to say that that Douglas agreed with everything Brown did, and in fact Brown approached Douglas to try to get him to join in the Harper's Ferry expedition, and Douglas refused. He thought it was a suicide mission. He had been much more receptive to some of Brown's ideas about moving south and trying to wage a kind of guerrilla war in the mountains and providing a place for freed slaves to come to and train. But he thought Harper's Ferry was folly.
We have another question. Are you hopeful that today's Black Lives Matter movement can learn something from Douglas's moderation? Where do you see the energy of the protesters headed? Is the state of the union intact?
No, I'm not particularly hopeful that the movement would learn something from Douglas's moderation. I think at least the organizers are much too informed by a view that the American founding is, you know, racist through and through, racist in its DNA, that critical race theory and things like that are really informing Black Lives Matter. I do suppose that those who are really interested in bringing about changes in policing will, you know, begin to realize that you've got to work through the system, and so that there will be some, you know, good results with respect to police training and laws and things like that. On the State of the Union, I'm just going to leave that one alone. We all have our own views of that, but the more people can be brought to read these texts from the past and really think them through, you know, the better off we'll be.
Okay, our next question is from my colleague, Marzora Shukla. In the final section of the speech, in addition to speaking of honoring Lincoln as Blacks honoring themselves, Douglas speaks of this quote, fastening ourselves to a name and fame imperishable and immortal in order to, quote, defend ourselves from blighting scandal, foul reproach, and the attempt to scourge us beyond the range of human brotherhood, and quoting from some different sections there. What do you think is the function of this invocation of the injustice with which Blacks continued to live at the end of the speech? Does it show Douglas as performing gratitude in the context of ongoing deep and just grievance?
Yeah, very interesting question. And I'm glad to see you going directly to the text itself. I mean, for one thing, this is just typical of Douglas. He will always try to show the full truth. So he's not going to back off from pointing to this continuing injustice. The speech is much designed to, you know, to defend ourselves from that blighting slander. I don't quite know what to make of your saying that he's performing gratitude. If by performing gratitude, you mean to imply that there is something inauthentic about that or something staged about it. I think he doesn't regard gratitude as, you know, simply an emotion. It's a virtue, and yeah, the virtues are in a sense performed or acted out. The question in a way shows what a complicated speech it is. He is expecting perhaps some transformation in the hearts of others, in the hearts of whites, at this display, right, of gratitude. And he understands it as a display, and in that sense as a performance. But I don't think that takes away from the sincerity of the gratitude. And it is kind of interesting that Douglas makes so much of gratitude. In so many ways, his philosophy is just the, you know, straightforward Lockean teaching on rights. You know, people are entitled to their rights. And if that's true, when your rights are acknowledged or respected or granted, why should there be any gratitude for that? You know, you're only getting what you deserve. The slaves deserved freedom. Why should they feel any gratitude? But it seems to me there are a couple of ways in which Douglas, works certain changes on that liberal teaching. So he also says things like, it isn't enough to be entitled to your rights. You have to, in a way, prove your worthiness. And this is, of course, why he thought it was so important for Blacks to fight in the war. Freedom can't just be given. And if it is, the givers will never quite regard you as worthy. He knows that America began in a revolutionary moment through an assertion, willingness to risk life for liberty. And he believes that Blacks will only be respected if they show that same kind of commitment, that willingness to hazard. So even though everyone is entitled to their rights, he is aware that human nature doesn't, you know, he says things like this all the time, you know, a man without force is just not going to be acknowledged. So that's one way in which he sort of works a certain change on that liberal teaching, but then also in his understanding of gratitude. So you have to be willing to assert your rights and risk them and show you're worthy of them. But then when your rights are secured, you should be willing to show gratitude to fellow citizens. I think he thinks that without that foundation, there won't be that common bond. So he's very intent on evoking this and generating it.
Thank you. The next question, presumably because you use this phrase, might be a little oblique to the lecture, but can you explain what critical race theory is?
Well, not very well, because this is sort of new to me, but I can point you in a very good direction. Just this afternoon, Harvey Mansfield, the Program on Constitutional Government, had Coleman Hughes. He's a very young man, African-American. He's 24 years old. And he gave a great praises of critical race theory. It's a notion that emerged out of elite law schools at a certain point and was for a while just restricted to the academy, but it now seems to be filtering out much more broadly. And so I think you can see its ramifications everywhere. I mean, one of the ideas, of course, is that it's impossible for Blacks to be racist. Only whites can be racist. I asked Coleman about this new naming practice that has emerged just recently, where Black is always uppercase and white is always lowercase. So you could see it in somebody like Kendi, right, where you now have to use, it's not enough to be not a racist, you have to be an anti-racist, and that means using law and government to sort of reverse the hierarchies, to dismantle white supremacy, white power. Anyway, that was very inadequate. So I would encourage you to check out the podcast from the Program on Constitutional Government and see what Coleman Hughes had to say about it. It was the best short description I've seen of it, really tackling the main premises of critical race theory.
Before I take the next question, I just want to remind people, in addition to the written questions we have coming in, if anyone would like to raise their hand and we can turn on your microphone and take some live voice questions too. If I'd seen this, I would have gone to this. This is Ms. Shukla was following up, I think, clarifying the performative comment that it should be understood in a political rather than an emotional register. I'm guessing that she typed that at the point at which you were speculating about what she might have meant by the performative. So I don't know if you want to add anything there. It's your answer might have touched on it already.
Yeah. And also, there is a political purpose to it. And as I said, I think he doesn't understand gratitude simply as an emotion, but really as a virtue.
Okay. Next question. Dear Professor Schaub, thank you for your lecture. I do appreciate your comments on Douglas, but I would like to ask about your critique of today's activists and protesters. Douglas may be appreciative of the ideals that the Constitution stands for, but modern critique of it might have to do with the lack of inclusivity and equality for all. With inequality written into it, I believe that the Constitution is flawed despite it espousing some noble ideals. What is the Constitution to you that makes you think that BLM activists are wrong to criticize it in the way they do? And could you elaborate on how we should honestly appreciate/criticize the Constitution for what it is?
Yeah, we would need to look at some other works by Douglas, especially his rethinking of the Constitution and his conclusion that the Constitution is a glorious liberty document. So Douglas does not believe that inequality is written into the Constitution. He says, we the people, there is nothing exclusionary about that. At the time of the adoption of the Constitution, there were free Black voters in many of the states. So I got a passage here that I can maybe read from Douglas. I think this would be his response to the radicals today. He would think they are making a grave mistake. Douglas is unsparing. He says, how dare any man who pretends to be a friend to the Negro thus gratuitously concede away what the Negro has a right to claim under the Constitution? I suspect he would repeat that rebuke today. I'm not sure what good can come from arguing, as you know, Hannah Jones does in the 1619 Project, that there's a straight line from the Constitution of 1787 to the Dred Scott decision of 1857. I mean, one would have no sense reading her or many like her that Tawney's opinion in that case was widely regarded as a travesty of justice. Douglas labeled it a judicial incarnation of wolfishness. And it wasn't just the abolitionists like Douglas. I mean, this was the platform of the Republican Party, right, calling for Dred Scott to be overturned. So I certainly agree that there is a lot of racism in American society from that early period on forward. But I don't agree that that racism is enshrined in the Constitution. And here, I mean, we would have to, you know, get kind of into the nitty gritty and look particularly at those passages in the Constitution that have some relevance to slavery and were understood to have some relevance to slavery. So I would just point you in the direction of Douglas's final reading of the Constitution from an 1860 speech called, I don't think it's phrases a question, is the Constitution pro-slavery or not, or something like that. But it's an 1860 speech, and he really lays out exactly how he understands each of those supposed, slave clauses.
Okay, the next question from Noah. Academic thought doesn't exist in a vacuum. Given that you mentioned present struggles for racial justice, I'm curious to know how you expect this lecture to contribute to or influence that struggle.
I'm just a reader of old texts, so I'm not going to claim that it could have much influence, other than to encourage other people to become students of these texts. And I think if we do that, then we at least have a chance of deepening the current conversation, bringing some other perspectives to bear. Otherwise, all we get is the, you know, sort of media influence, journalistic understanding of things. So it's not to say that there, you know, weren't disagreements in the past. We need to go back and you know, compare Douglas's reading of the Constitution to Lincoln's reading of the Constitution. They're not identical. And one would need to, you know, think through which of those readings of the Constitution are more persuasive to you. But for both of those men, they were prepared to vindicate the founders.
I'm going to skip for a second. I think we got maybe the earlier question or following up midstream on your answer about Douglas's reading of the Constitution.
Yeah.
Typed here is, but the three-fourths clause, I think the three-fifths.
Three-fifths clause, yeah.
So you might have already spoken to it in your...
Well, no, not really. I mean, I didn't talk about the details of it. The three-fifths clause. So what does the three-fifths clause mean? It means that, remember, the distinction in the three-fifths clause is not a racial distinction. It is not between Black and white. All free residents are to be counted in full. Slaves are to be discounted, right? Three-fifths of the slaves. Why was that the case? Well, put yourself back into the Constitutional Convention. Who was in favor of counting slaves in full in the Constitutional Convention? It was the pro-slavery delegates, or the delegates who wanted to strengthen the power of the slave states, those states who had the biggest numbers of slaves. They wanted slaves to count in full, not because they were recognizing the humanity of their slaves, but because they wanted to increase their own voting power in Congress. Who was it who didn't want slaves to count at all? It was the anti-slavery delegates. Why? Because counting slaves at all makes a mockery, for one thing, of the principle of representation, because slaves were being counted, but they weren't going to have a vote or a voice. So it made a mockery of the principle of representation. And because allowing slaves to count at all would increase the power of the slaveholders. So in other words, that was a political battle over which side would have more weight in the new Congress, in the House of Representatives, the pro-slavery or the anti-slavery side. It was not a debate that touched at all on the humanity of Blacks. Free Blacks, one-tenth, remember, of the Black population was free. Free Blacks were counted in full. And so what Douglas eventually says about the three-fifths clause, he says you could read it as a disability that was laid upon the slaveholding states. It deprived them of two-fifths of the natural basis of representation, the natural basis of representation being simply population. So they were being punished for having slavery. Now, of course, it was a bargain, and so you can look at it from either side. You can say either they were being, you know, punished for having slavery, or they were getting an unfair bonus, right? Because they got to count their slaves towards the rule of representation and their political power. But the main point, right, is that that clause has nothing at all to say about the humanity of Blacks. I wish this was live. I mean, I'd like to see who's asking and allow the asker to respond. And
I'll just
we're missing something really essential here in not being able to engage. But do we want to go up to the one that was skipped?
We have another question. What do you really believe about Lincoln? Was he poisoned by white prejudice, or was he trying to accommodate and work with the spirit of the citizenry in order to fulfill the ideals of the Constitution?
Yeah, I think my ultimate view is the latter. I don't think he was poisoned by white prejudice. He shows himself on so many occasions to be aware of it as a problem. And aware that even if there is some extent to which he has that prejudice, he recognizes it as a wrong, as something that he would need to work to purge. I also would cite things like in the Peoria Address, 1854, where he makes clear that the meaning of the Declaration requires not just an end to slavery, but the vote for all. In fact, I could probably grab that passage really quickly. So let me see if I can find it here. It's in Peoria, and it's actually in the dead center of the very long Peoria Address. So he says, he quotes directly from the Declaration. And then he says, "I have quoted so much at this time, merely to show that according to our ancient faith, the just powers of the government are derived from the consent of the governed. Now, the relation of masters and slaves is pro tanto a total violation of this principle. The master not only governs the slave without his consent, but he governs him by a set of rules altogether different from those which he prescribes for himself. Allow all," and he capitalizes all, allow full, you know, all caps, every single letter of it, "allow all," A-L-L, "the governed an equal voice in the government, and that only is self-government." So in 1854, Lincoln had made it perfectly clear that if Blacks after slavery were to remain in the United States, you know, not pursue colonization, if they were to remain, the self-government would mean allowing them an equal voice in the government, the consent of the governed. Now, what does he do right after he says that? He backpedals. And he says, "Let it not be said that I'm contending for the establishment of political and social equality between the whites and blacks. I have already said the contrary. I am not now combating the argument of necessity arising from the fact that the blacks are already amongst us." And he goes on and on. Seems to me what he's just indicated there is, yeah, he can't now call for full political equality. That would be political suicide and would destroy the chances of actually getting rid of slavery first. In other words, you must do what is most urgent first. But the way in which Lincoln prosecutes the battle going on over the extension of slavery, he prosecutes that in a way that does not stand in the way of future improvement towards a fuller realization of the equality principle. Now, there were some who were trying to get rid of slavery in the territories and doing it through with appeals to racism, right? By saying, we want that territory for whites and we don't want any blacks there. And, we don't want slavery because we are because we're anti-black. But Lincoln is very careful to always formulate the anti-slavery cause in a way that will sort of keep it, put it on this trajectory to the next steps that would come after that.
Thank you. I think we sort of have a follow-up there from Janet Dougherty, my colleague. What do you make of Lincoln's break from Jefferson? From Jefferson in the eulogy of Henry Clay.
Can you tell me what you mean by that? I guess I don't know that he breaks from Jefferson. I know he quotes Jefferson. I think he quotes him on the wolf by the ears comment of Jefferson. I do think that what Lincoln is doing in that eulogy of Henry Clay is quite brilliant. The Democrats, of course, were positioning themselves to actually be the heirs to Henry Clay, the Whig, by saying that, they were the ones who represented the spirit of compromise. And I think what Lincoln does in that eulogy of Clay is not to concentrate so much on Clay as, the author of all of these compromises. What he draws out about Clay is Clay's commitment to liberty, including liberty for the slaves. In other words, he stresses Clay's anti-slavery credentials. And of course, he has a certain political purpose in doing that. He hopes to claim the mantle of Clay for himself rather than allowing Douglas to claim that mantle of Clay.
We got a follow-up comment from Janet. The context of the letter is Jefferson's opposition to the Missouri Compromise.
Yes. Okay, good. Yeah, you're right. Lincoln, remember, Jefferson's view was this view called the diffusionist thesis, where you would better be able to get rid of slavery if you allowed slavery to spread itself more thinly over the land. Right. The problem with getting rid of slavery is that, there are some places where slaves are the majority. And that, that's the wolf by the ears argument. So if you could spread slavery out, then it might be easier to get rid of it. And you're right that Lincoln thinks that is just a Pollyanna argument, a lullaby argument. He puts no credence at all in that. He says that, what will happen if you allow slavery to spread, you will end up putting more people into slavery. And of course, if you allow slavery to spread in the territories, that will just create pressure to revive the international slave trade. And he says you will have deprived yourself of the moral argument on which you could resist the reinstitution of the international slave trade. But he does not indicate that he's departing from Jefferson there. He always says all honor to Jefferson, right? Jefferson is the author of the Declaration of Independence. He's behind the exclusion of slavery from the Northwest Territories. He believes, he gives Jefferson credit for being the sort of formulator of this position that would keep slavery out of the territories. He, you know, always refers to the earlier Jefferson there. So he kind of buries his departure from Jefferson on the diffusionist thesis.
Thank you. Next question. This lecture helped to contextualize the emancipation statue. I must admit that the first time I saw it, I found it jarring. I wonder how we can better give context to statues and monuments. Do you have any ideas or suggestions towards this?
Yeah, I mean, one thing, you just have to look at them more. And I imagine we all need some instruction in, you know, art appreciation. And there are certain sorts of, you know, conventions and things you need to learn about, you know, the symbolism. And so when you have a plinth like that, you want to look carefully at what's depicted on it. And you have to understand the various, you know, the various symbols that are used. So that would help some. But especially with a statue like this, I think our kind of instinctual reaction against it, you know, that's just, it's just more instantaneous. We are really uncomfortable with that sort of a depiction. I think you see the difference in, think of, you know, one of these equestrian statues, right? The sort of heroic statues. When you look at that, I think you can simply translate yourself, you know, into the person on horseback. So you can identify with the hero. But when you see the kind of depiction that you get in the emancipation statue, when you see the inequality there, that's what we are made uncomfortable by. And by the way, there's a very similar statue of Booker T. Washington at Tuskegee, where Booker T. Washington is standing behind a, again, a sort of, you know, newly freed person educating themselves. And he's sort of lifting the veil from their eyes. And that statue also, I think, has provoked opposition. So I think it really is rooted in our views of equality. You know, we want equality to be automatic, and we don't like to think about what's necessary in the way of development to achieve equality.
Thank you. Maybe a little bit of a rhetorical question coming next here. What a magnificent lecture and discussion. So refreshing. Why are there so many deaf ears in today's America?
Well, I suppose I could pile on there, but maybe it's always the case, right? I mean, we've read our Plato. We're all in one cave or another. It's not easy to get yourself out of the cave. So I'm just back with liberal education and what liberal education can make possible for students.
Thank you. We have another question here that has some context for St. John's that you might be aware of, but in any case, I'll just read the question as it stands. Yeah. What of the statue of Teddy Roosevelt on horseback at New York's Natural History Museum?
Yeah, well, you're taking me out of my depth here. I am not an art critic. I know the statue, and I know that it has also occasioned a lot of opposition. I did read from somebody, I can't remember from whom, a defense of it. You know, again, an attempt to read it more carefully and see more there, to see what might be redeemed or redemptive in it. But I can't make the argument. I just I haven't looked carefully enough at that one.
We've had some prominent members of our community on both sides of.
Of that.
Yeah.
Well, all the more reason not to step into that one then.
maybe. Okay, I don't think we have another question teed up right now, so let's just wait a moment or two and see if we get either another written question or anybody raising their hand. If you have any. Anything you want to circle back to in the meantime, you may, but we do not, we cultivate an ethos of being willing to endure silence for a while. And so we'll wait a minute or two and see if anything comes.
What do they read at St. John's from Douglas? Do you read some of the narrative or?
It's varied and it might vary now across the two campuses, but it's usually selections of some speeches, I think, including the one you referenced about the Constitution, the question of the Constitution being pro-slavery, usually read with writings of Lincoln as part of a sequence and even on the same night. But it's varied quite a bit over the years, and we might have somebody tighten it up for me. I could pull up our seminar reading list. In fact, maybe I will while we're looking at it.
So not the narrative though. The narrative.
Well, it has been done, but I don't believe that's what we do now.
And from Lincoln, both the Gettysburg Address and the Second Inaugural, or
often and other speeches as well over the course of a couple of seminars. While we're chatting, I'll go ahead and pull it up, and I can tell you right now what we're doing. I see we got a question, so I was going to get distracted here. So let me read this, and then I'll answer your question in a moment. From John Carpenter, how did Douglas and Du Bois differ in their approaches to education for the slaves? And I will mention, Diana, we read in our senior year now over two nights all of The Souls of Black Folk.
This one, you know, they are in really different generations. I mean, Douglas does live until 1895, and Du Bois at that point is just sort of coming on the scene. So the usual pairing is to think more about the disagreement between Booker T. Washington and Du Bois on education. I guess I would say that Douglas is closer to Booker T. Washington. Both Douglas and Washington are born into slavery, and Douglas is almost entirely self-educated. So I think they have a sense of what's necessary for the great masses of Black folks after the Civil War, that you really have to begin at the beginning. And so it will be basic education, and especially what came to be called industrial education. So in that letter that Harry Beecher Stowe wrote to Douglas saying, you know, what can I do for the freed people? He did recommend, putting her money towards industrial education. And what was meant by that is skilled trades, you know, as a route to sort of middle class status. So Douglas, I think, felt the need for Blacks to move out of menial employment towards, you know, skilled employment and skilled trades. I think he certainly would not have been, you know, opposed to college education for the freedmen. But it doesn't seem to me that that's where his major effort lay. And Booker T. Washington, you know, is one who very much takes that argument and embraces it. Du Bois is famous for his essay on the Talented Tenth. Du Bois believes that the race will be saved by its exceptional individuals. He believes in a kind of trickle-down theory of culture. You have to have those who are the elite, right, who will be able to guide and lead the masses. So he's very interested in the education of that elite. And Du Bois writes beautifully about liberal education and what it can achieve, both what it can achieve practically in terms of, you know, kind of political education for the elites, but also just what liberal education means for the individual. There's that beautiful passage from Du Bois, you know, I sit with Shakespeare and he winces not, I summon Aristotle and Aurelius and what soul I will, and they come all graciously with no scorn nor condescension, and so wed with truth, I dwell above the veil. It's a beautiful image, but Washington's view, and I actually think there's an awful lot to be said for Washington's view, is that culture begins with agriculture. It begins from the ground up, and you have to cultivate that. You have to proceed along certain steps. Also, you know, what Washington was trying to do was just make sure that whites would permit, that whites in the South would permit education for Blacks. And he had to show them what interest they might have in Black advancement, Black economic advancement, and Black educational advancement. I don't know if that was sufficient on that or not, but those are great texts to read. In fact, I think there's a really wonderful essay from Washington called Democracy in Education, where I think it's very clear that his interest in education is not just an economic interest, but is ultimately a political interest. He's thinking about how you educate for citizenship.
Okay, thank you. We have another question. Critical race theory promotes the idea that race is a social construct. You have spoken about the different races as if grounded in nature. Did I understand you correctly?
No, you did not. So this is an important clarification. I think I agree with Douglas on this. Douglas thinks that race is purely a matter of skin tone. So in that sense, it exists, color exists. There are differences in color and they fall across a spectrum. So I don't think it's only critical race theory that believes that race is a social construct. I think that Douglas thinks it's a social construct. I think that Lincoln thinks it's a social construct. I think clear in Lincoln, Lincoln tries to avoid using the word race. Race is the way that, you know, those who are interested in maintaining white supremacy in his day, they embraced the language of race. Tawney, Stephen Douglas always spoke about race. Lincoln always speaks about color. And he makes clear that color is a matter of shades. Right? It's just across a spectrum. And Douglas also, I think, speaks more about color. He believes that race is narrow and humanity is large, that he tries to encourage he's trying to move American society to a place where it will no longer be race conscious or so race conscious. I'd like to, do you want to type something back so we can pursue it further?
We'll see if if that comes. And we have another lull. I did look at our current reading list. The question of the piece on the question of whether the Constitution is pro-slavery, I think, is the only Douglas we read in the fixed seminar readings right now. And it's together with Dred Scott and Lincoln on Dred Scott and the Cooper Union speech. We have another seminar that has several speeches by Lincoln. And in that sequence, which also includes Tocqueville, we then move on to Du Bois after that. That's in the spring of the senior year that students are reading those texts.
Yeah, you know, if they're going to read the whole of Souls of Black Folk, that includes the essay that criticizes Booker T. Washington, right? In fairness to Washington, you should probably have students read a speech by Washington called The Intellectuals and the Boston Mob.
Sounds like, at the very least, a good, what we sometimes call guerrilla seminar. And Washington has come on and off in similar sequences over the years. And again, things get read in other classes, but when we're looking at our sort of core required seminar reading list, that's what's in that sequence now. Mm-hmm. We'll wait another minute. Oh, people may be, including you, maybe ready to adjourn for the weekend. Oh, we have a
Friday night, although there's nowhere to go. So
let's see. I think this is the questioner following up. In any case, thank you for your answer about race. It is so sensible. I've had a knee-jerk reaction to the social construct idea until now. You have helped me overcome that. Okay, we do have another question and from the earlier questioner, Noah. When I asked how you expect this lecture to influence present struggles for racial justice, you responded with, "I'm just a reader of texts." I think you might've said old text. I take great issue with that because it seems to be a refusal to recognize any link between political theory and political practice. At the end of your lecture, you not only mentioned the present struggle for racial justice, but seemed to imply it was lacking in some way. Can you please elaborate?
I don't mean to deny a link between political theory and political practice, but I guess I can only say that to the extent that I have expertise, it's in the texts. And so I want to bring students to those texts, and I don't want to dictate what they derive from the texts about the contemporary moment. I want to equip them to think better and more deeply about the contemporary moment. But I guess I'm very sensitive to what I think is a kind of politicization of the classroom. And I don't want to engage in that myself. Second part here, I mentioned the present struggle for racial justice, but seemed to imply it was lacking in some way. I do think it's lacking in some way. I think it has taken a turn influenced by the Black Power movement and the sort of mainstreaming of the Black Power movement, so that the struggle is, I think, no longer primarily envisioned as a biracial quest for justice. Douglass worked together side by side with white abolitionists. White abolitionists and Black abolitionists worked together to bring about an end to slavery. He never conceived of the struggle as racial, you know, in a certain fundamental sense. He did not conceive it as a racial struggle. The same thing is true of King. Right. He spoke of a biracial army. He did not formulate the issue as Black versus white. He formulated the issue as justice. For those who were being wrongly excluded. And yes, the impulse behind the exclusion was racial. It was racist. But what I think happened, and we can see it very much now in the way at least some protesters formulate the issue. It's that America altogether is shameful. It's formulated. It's formulated in terms of black versus white. It's all white supremacy. It's all white power, which has to be replaced with black power. So it's not quite as stark as it was sort of in the original formulation of black power by folks like Stokely Carmichael. So there's been a certain mainstreaming of it. And so it's changed a little bit. But it seems to me more divisive than it has to be. I don't want to go. I don't want to get too much into details. But you could, you know, talk about the way in which the police are talked about. And I think there are serious problems. But I don't think the way things are formulated now is the most helpful way to approach and ameliorate those problems.
Another question from Anna Maria. Du Bois borrowed Douglass's phrase, the color line, as a guiding idea in the souls of black folk. Do you feel Du Bois picked up the work that Douglass left undone?
In part yes and in part no. Du Bois was intent on opposing segregation and Jim Crow. All of that is a continuation of Douglass. But I think there is a real shift in Du Bois towards cultural nationalism and a kind of black nationalism that is utterly absent from Douglass and that I think he would have been a serious critic of. So you can see this in a work of Du Bois, an early work from Du Bois, The Conservation of Races, where Du Bois argues that it is important to maintain group separation and group solidarity, that blacks sort of have a message to deliver to the world, as every people does, as every race does. In other words, Du Bois is a race theorist, right? And Douglass rejects the idea of race. So Du Bois says that, you know, we want to found a Negro Academy so that we can formulate Negro art and Negro culture and, you know, Negro social science. So he's calling for a certain separation. Now, it's not the thoroughgoing separation of the later black nationalists. I mean, he's not arguing for immigration or, you know, leaving America. He says we can find a way both to sort of develop Negroness and participate in the larger America, that you can combine, you know, there can be a sort of nation within a nation. But Douglass is a complete integrationist. Right? Douglass actually envisions a time where there will be a new composite American race, that there will be so much blending, so much intermarriage, that he celebrates in a way this amalgamationist vision. And he says he himself is a kind of embodiment of it. His mother was black, his father was white, presumed to be his first master. And there is apparently Native American heritage as well on his mother's side. So he regarded himself as a kind of blending of America's three races. And he thought that was the American future. And it might take a long time, but he pointed the nation in that direction. I mean, using the argument, if we actually become less prejudiced, we won't see race in that same way, and people's affections will follow the dictates of their heart, and there will be this blending. And Du Bois says, absolutely not. He says that that would be to do a disservice to your race.
So I think we might let that be the last question. Professor Schaub, I'd like to give you the more or less the final word if there's anything you'd like to close with. But before I do that, I just want to thank everyone for attending and just generally thank our community for participating in improvising and adapting to our fall lecture series. And I'd like to thank you very much for joining us this evening. It was a very timely, they might be old texts, but as the questions show, a very timely set of texts and set of questions that you raise. We're very grateful for you sharing your reading and the depth of your scholarship and your attachment to liberal education with us this evening.
Yeah, so the last word is just go back to Douglass's oration and read it. Can't be better than that.
Thank you so much. And with that, we will close. Thank you all for attending.
Thanks.